right, this is Pure Decking show number 427, also known as, my God, we're still doing this. How long now? like a decade.
11 years.
Good God.
Have I known you people that long?
Yeah. 2011, man, was when we decided to form Galaxy 15, so yeah, nearly.
You mean that's when I got drunk and registered a domain name.
And we were doing it 2 years before that.
Yeah, doing the old IHN stuff, sure.
Yeah.
This is the show for Thursday, March the 4th, 1956. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and waiting for the worms to come. Tonight, I have Madman.
I have four roses, and that makes life wonderful.
I'm actually
if you drink enough of it.
I'm actually polishing off a bottle of Inferno. So, I'm completely blanking on the name of this wine. I haven't even had that much of it. Fuck.
Yellowtail?
No. It's a U.S. brand. I did get some of that Yellowtail. It's a decent drinking wine too.
Good with steak.
Apothic. I don't know why I couldn't think of that. But the Inferno is kind of a. They say they're bourbon barrel aging it, so I'm not getting a heck of a lot of the oak out of that. But Psychro says we've now been doing this as long as SK did Newsreel. Good God. Should that be a metric?
Oh, man.
Should I be as much of an asshole as Sim was? Or am I worse? I'd have to ask you guys that one, actually, wouldn't I?
let me grab my scuba tank. I have to go find sea monsters.
Who's going to get naked in the woods?
Oh, Madman, you volunteered for that one.
Madman, you can do it.
I mean, nobody's going to be out there to film it or anything for you, but, I mean,
I was just thinking, who has the body type like Sean Kennedy when he shot that? Madman. See, who am I insulting, Sean or Madman?
I don't know.
You can't tell. Kids, that's how a good insult's done.
I should finish the intro. Are you is here.
I had a really racist joke for the opening that involved Dr. Seuss, but I decided not to do it.
So, well, I guess the big one to lead off with is this is bad. Four actively exploited zero-day flaws found in Microsoft Exchange, specifically Outlook Web Access. Yeah, I've got two articles here. I've got the one from the Hacker News detailing the actual vulnerabilities. And then I've got the fact that the U.S. government issued a warning over it because China was using them. Microsoft has released emergency patches to address four previously undisclosed security flaws in Exchange Server that it says are being actively exploited by a new Chinese state-sponsored threat actor with the goal of perpetuating data theft. And the thing is, for anybody who doesn't know, Microsoft Exchange is the number one corporate email server. And because it's email, it's quite often internet exposed, and they use a web interface called Outlook Web Access, which is basically the self-hosted version of what Microsoft sells for Office 365 from the email standpoint. Now Office 365 has a bunch of other stuff incorporated into it, but yeah, this is the email server, and before Microsoft was selling it in Office 365, everyone ran their own Exchange. And you had a handful of competitors out there. You had your Zimbras, you had your Lotus your Lotus email server. IBM sold one. Of course, there's the open source stuff. But Exchange is kind of the modern internet email server, the modern business email server. So, and if you're going to go after emails, you want to go after business emails because that's where you're going to get all of your information. Because, I mean, Madman, I know you work in a, you know, financial as well. Everything goes over email. Every fucking thing goes over email.
Supposed to be encrypted email. Question how encrypted it is, but yeah, everything goes over email.
Yeah. And even if it is encrypted email, most of the time it's stored on your local email unencrypted, especially if it's using the Microsoft encryption, because that's what it does. So it's only encrypted when it goes out in transport. So anyways, describing the attacks as limited and targeted, Microsoft Threat Intelligence Center said the adversaries used these vulnerabilities to access on-premise Exchange servers, in turn granting access to email accounts and paving the way for the installation of additional malware to facilitate long-term access to victim environments. The tech giant primarily attributed the campaign with high confidence to a threat actor it calls Hafnium, a state-sponsored hacker collective operating out of China, although it suspects other groups may be involved. Discussing the tactics, techniques, and procedures of the group for the first time, Microsoft paints H-A-F-N-U-I-M, so Hafnium, I guess is how you'd say that, as a, quote, highly skilled and sophisticated actor, unquote, that mainly singles out entities in the U.S. for exfiltrating sensitive information from an array of industrial sectors, including infectious disease researchers, law firms, higher education, defense contractors, policy think tanks, and NGOs. Hafnium is believed to orchestrate its attacks by leveraging leased virtual private servers in the U.S. to attempt to cloak its malicious activity. The three-stage attack involves gaining access to the Exchange server with either stolen passwords or by using previously undisclosed or undiscovered vulnerabilities, followed by deploying a web shell to control the compromised server remotely. The last link in the attack chain makes use of remote access to plunder mailboxes from an organization's network and export the collected data to file-sharing sites like Mega. So you ever want to know why your corporate emails, your corporate security team blocks Mega Upload and other file sharing sites and file locker sites and Dropbox and all that shit? This is why.
Here it is. Nope.
To achieve this, as many as 4 zero-day vulnerabilities discovered by researchers from Volexity and Dubex are part of the attack chain. CVE-2021-26855, a server-side request forgery vulnerability in Exchange. 26857, insecure deserialization vulnerability in Unified Messaging Service. Those are scary. Deserialization vulnerabilities are interesting because what that really is, how do I explain this? When you take usually it's an object in code, but it's a data structure, and you want to send it over the network, over the internet especially, usually in an API or something like that, it has to be encoded into a string, just a string of characters. So you need some way to serialize the data. So the simplest thing to think of would be something like comma-separated values. More modern versions are things like JSON and even XML. Can be thought of as serialization to a point. JSON's probably one of your most common ones. And deserialization is where you try to interpret that data back and make your objects out of it. So if you can find a bug in the deserialization engine, I can send an object to your code, to your API, for example. And when it goes to decode it to even see what it is, I'm triggering a bug. So a lot of times deserialization vulnerabilities can affect, you just need the server exposed. You don't need creds. You don't need a specific library. It just is the thing out there. And, when it's in something like the Unified Messaging Service, which is the email gateway, that's basically just, I sent you an email and now I have root. that's bad. Post authentication arbitrary file write vulnerability exchange and a post authentication arbitrary file write vulnerability. It's 2021-26858 and 2021-27065. Although the vulnerabilities impact Microsoft's Exchange Server 2013, Server 2016, and Exchange Server 2019, Microsoft said it's updating Exchange Server 2020. 10 for defense in depth purposes, i.e. they know enough people out there are still running really old Exchange servers that they better put the patch out, or it's going to be, you know, you'll have a lot of people saying, let's move off of Exchange entirely because it's vulnerable. So, furthermore, since the initial attack requires an untrusted connection to Exchange port 443, the company notes that organizations can mitigate the issue by restricting untrusted connections or by using VPN to separate Exchange server from external access. And for the record, port 443 is usually used for Outlook web access. So that's the web-based mailboxes rather than using like an email client like Outlook or Microsoft Mail or Thunderbird. So... they're working on patches and nmap plugins for detection and things like that, but this is a you know, fuck your weekend if you're in the security teams kind of thing, because I know the moment this stuff dropped, 443, yes, DPView, that is in fact HTTPS, which is why I was talking about that being the web, Outlook web connection, OWA. But related to that, I have from NBC News here that some mail servers will still let you connect and send email on odd ports, so I guess it's not impossible that you might, you know, have your SMTP server listening on that port, but that would be strange. And then of course we've got the US issues warning after Microsoft says China hacked its mail server program. U.S. has issued an emergency warning after Microsoft said it caught China hacking into its mail and calendaring server program called Exchange. The perpetrator, Microsoft said in a blog post, is a hacker group that the company has high confidence is working for the Chinese government and spies primarily on American targets. The latest software update for Exchange blocks the hacks, prompting U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, to issue a rare emergency directive that requires all government networks to do so. CISA, the U.S.'s primary defensive cybersecurity agency, rarely exercises its authority to demand that the entire U.S. government to take steps to protect its cybersecurity. And I would bet because that's probably, they don't have the kind of enforcement that you want. Unfortunately, most of the time when it comes down to cybersecurity enforcement, it's harassing emails and phone calls that your systems are breaking policy and you need to fix it. And usually it's, well, we can't fix it right now, but we can give you a plan to fix it. And then you go back and forth with audit and bullshit like that, and things don't really actually get fixed at a technical level for years. But they'll argue about having a plan for it and that therefore they're compliant because they have a plan to fix it. No, I'm not bitter. Anyways,
But the regulation doesn't say plan, it says fix.
Okay, they're not fixing it anyways. What do you do?
Yeah, I don't know. If you don't have the position, the ability to fire them or dock the money, you don't do anything.
Exactly. You're just annoying them into doing it. Basically, all you can do is go up the chain, go to their boss and say they need to fix this and see what they say. But
I've turned off their email access.
I might have resorted to that in the past. It's like, well, they're continuing to access vulnerable information, so we blocked their computer from the internet because we believe it's compromised. We might claim computers are compromised to get cooperation out of people. That might happen. You know, hey, you know, either you're going to cooperate with us or we're going to have to send your machines off to forensics for further analysis. Oh, yeah, no, that means we're FedExing them off to the forensics team. You know, you're not going to have a computer for a week. Well, we're going to miss our deadline because of that. Well.
And?
Yeah. So, you know, might have had those arguments in the past, too, where they... I would be lying if I said I hadn't seen a CSO use that forensics thing as a... Anyways. It's like, yeah, we know that there's nothing actually on their machine, but they pissed us off, so... They're getting punished by sending their machine off to forensics. Anyways. And, oh, yeah, they're going over that machine with a fine-tooth comb to see if there's anything else they can nail them on because, like I said, they pissed off somebody important. Okay. So, in a separate blog post, Microsoft Vice President Tom Burt wrote that the hackers have recently spied on a wide range of American targets, including disease researchers, law firms, and defense contractors. Burt added the company had seen no evidence that individual consumers were targeted, but emphasized that the hacker group has previously targeted infectious disease. Yeah, that's the same list I read earlier. So, contacted by email, a spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington referred to recent comments by spokesperson Wang Wenbin. China has reiterated on multiple occasions that given the virtual nature of cyberspace and the fact that there are all kinds of online actors who are difficult to trace, tracing the source of cyber attacks is a complex technical issue. We hope that relevant media and companies will adopt a professional and responsible attitude and underscore the importance to have enough evidence when identifying cyber-related incidents rather than making groundless accusations. I didn't hear a denial in there, did you?
No. No denial.
Yeah. It goes on saying that there's no immediate action and that, you know, there's a few other people making statements. But the gist of it is, this is bad because, I mean, most major companies are running Exchange for their mail servers. DPView says at least DoD-related stuff doesn't go over Exchange. Well, that's probably because they're still running, you know, either Lotus or, what was the Novell one? I forget what Novell was called. I know the suite was Groupware, but I don't remember what the email server was actually called in Novell. So,
no idea.
They're just using Telnet and, you know, Postfix. No, I doubt that that's what they're saying. It takes 30 minutes to send an email out. Jeez, they are running Novell. That or they're running some crazy ass custom in-house system that has to get through so many layers of translation before it gets to a real email system. Which, actually, I could see. But, that's bad. I know I got pulled into several phone calls earlier this week about it, and had to go digging for some things, and we had to put together a pretty immediate plan of requiring the ops guys to go patch their email boxes, which they were not very happy about because, you know, they wanted to do other things with their weekend. But, yeah.
Be them.
Well, I mean, that's the nature of the game, right? It's just,
yeah.
It sucks, but
it's like being a chef in a restaurant on a Saturday night and you close at fucking 1 and someone comes in at 12:30. It's the game.
It is the game.
What How many think? Businesses do you think are going to be a pop for this?
Well,
we'll never know, Madman. They'll never disclose.
There's that. But at the same time, if this group was really trying to keep this stuff on the down low, because that's the thing. Usually your more professional groups are not hacking anything and everything because they don't want their vulnerabilities to get found and patched. So it's possible that their usage of it was limited and Microsoft just got lucky and happened to catch it.
That's why I think it was Chinese. It looked like the real deal. It felt like the real deal, but it fell apart in a couple of hours. I tell you, you know, it was a Chinese hack.
But the fact that they got the patches out so quickly also makes me think Microsoft probably knew internally about some of these vulnerabilities and was working on code to fix it. And the fact that they are even patching server 2010 tells me they've probably known about it for a while and either just for whatever reason never fixed it. Maybe they couldn't get it past QA. Maybe they didn't want to answer questions, because there are people who will take the latest Microsoft patches, reverse engineer them, and then go look for anything they can hack with, you know, that just hasn't been patched yet. So it's possible they just didn't want to encourage people to go find these bugs. If you're being generous about it, if you're being less generous about it, they were might have been holding the fixes back until these programs went into extended support so that, you know, companies can pay more for it. For example, there were several companies that were paying Microsoft to continue to support Windows XP. Those patches didn't go public. They only went to the people who were paying them for the extended support. They just recently did that for Windows 7 as well, where Microsoft wasn't doing very much patching for Windows 7 because they're trying to get people off of, you know, Windows 10 or bust these days, right? So, you know, companies were paying for extended support, and they would get the patches through their, you know, Microsoft partnership, but they wouldn't be public patches. So it's possible they were hanging on to this stuff for extended support to publish it then when they get more money for it. But I don't know. It's kind of odd to hold patches like that back. So maybe they knew about it and were working on it, but it wasn't a priority. And then they find this, and so now it's a priority, so they rush it out. So that's going to be the next thing, is we find out these patches are unstable and crashing email servers or some other bullshit, right?
Yeah.
So, but the other thing is, you know, yeah, they put out a directive saying, oh, everyone in the government has to install these patches. Well, you know, either they'll have patches for it, or they'll have plans to have patches for it. You know, you can imagine in a fairly reasonable period of time, all this stuff's going to be patched up in most government agencies that are running Exchange. I'm sure not all of them are. You know, some of them are probably still running Lotus. Novell, Groupware. But the private sector, on the other hand, you've got a lot of companies that moved to Office 365 because it was a hell of a lot easier than maintaining their own Exchange servers. But you're still going to have small offices, schools, medium businesses that stood up their own Exchange infrastructure, and they don't maintain it. They have like one or two IT guys who have to run everything, and they might not patch this stuff for years. So it's not so much how much has gotten popped now, it's how much is going to get popped in the next couple of years while these patches are still relevant. This is going to be MS-60, you know, some of these stuff might be, you know, equivalent to the MS-0867, in that, you know, this stuff was patched in Windows XP Service Pack 3, and I was still using up until a few years ago to get into networks, reliably get into networks. So, you know, that's the other problem, is people just don't patch, and yeah. Moving on, VPNs. This is, did anybody else have anything on this, on the email before? Yeah. So that's, no, that's just, understand that it's bad, and you probably shouldn't be putting anything terribly confidential or trusting email ever. Like, just in general, you shouldn't trust email.
None.
I'm not kidding.
That's how a lot of businesses communicated now.
I know.
Instead of fax, it's email. It's better than the, I'm not going to say it's better. It's faster than the postal service and possibly as secure.
I mean,
I'm not sure how secure you would say the postal service was.
I could stage an envelope to know if it was tampered with or not. You know, the whole dual envelope thing where you, you know, do the layer of, you know, ink toner or laser toner between. Be able to tell real quick if somebody's tampered with it because there'll be fingerprints on the outer envelope. But, yeah, email's a mess. I mean, there are ways to make it better, but the problem is that none of the methods of making email better are universal. So, you know, let's implement email chain signing for everything, GPG and all that stuff, or, you know, OpenPGP or any of the email signing things. Well, everyone you work with has to run it and use it. And, I mean, getting two companies to agree on a version of Office to put documents in, let alone, you know, something as, you know, as difficult as key exchanges, good luck.
Oh, it's not just two companies, It's two companies and whatever regulatory agencies they have to deal with.
So
I don't care what company you are or how small you are. There's somebody that you have to get audited by these days.
And they're going to want everything, you know, in a very specific format. And I up until recently, I was dealing with auditors that wanted me to run some very old code on my domain controller so that they could, you know, dump out objects and things like that and do their audit. And it's like, this stuff was written for server 2003. I don't want to run this on my box. I don't want it on there. Well, this is what we use. Okay, you're not hearing me. I'm not putting this crusty piece of shit on my DC. Well, this is what we use. Okay, tell me what it does, and I will get you what you need. Well, no, we use this program. And, you know, round and round with my boss, and ultimately my boss had one of the ops guys put the crusty-ass program on there and run it, and, you know, I found it a few weeks later, and it's like, son of a bitch. So... Anyways, VPNs. This one's from Malwarebytes, blogged at malwarebytes.com. 21 million free VPN users' data has been exposed. Detailed credentials for more than 21 million mobile VPN app users were swiped and advertised for sale online last week, offered by a cyber thief who allegedly stole user data collected by the VPN apps themselves. The data includes email addresses, randomly generated password strings, payment information, and device IDs belonging to users of the three VPN apps, SuperVPN, GeckoVPN, and ChatVPN.
Those are VPNs no one wants to use. They keep logs.
Yeah, I like what DPV said in the IRC there, and he's reposting it just because he wants to make sure I see it. Imagine unironically, without irony, seriously using a free VPN and thinking your entire traffic isn't being sold off. You're right. The attacks, which have not been confirmed by the VPN developers, represent the most recent privacy broadsides against the VPN industry. Two similar blunders have been revealed to be public since 2019, including one massive data leak that exposed several VPN apps' empty promises to collect, quote, no logs of their users' activity. And that leak, not only did the VPN providers fail to live up to their words, but they also hoovered up additional data, including users' email addresses, clear text passwords, IP addresses, home addresses, phone models, and device IDs. For the average consumer, then, the privacy pitfalls begin to paint an all-too-familiar portrait. Users continue to feel alone when managing their online privacy, even when they rely on tools meant to enhance their privacy. Cybersecurity researcher Troy Hunt, who wrote about recent data leak on Twitter, called the entire issue, quote, a mess and a timely reminder of why trust in a VPN provider is so crucial, unquote. He continued, this level of logging isn't what anyone expects when using a service designed to improve privacy, not to mention the fact that they leaked all the data. In late February, a user on a popular hacking forum claimed they had stolen account information and credentials belonging to all users of three separate VPN apps available on Google Play Store for Android. The same three VPNs there. The three apps vary wildly in popularity. According to Google's play count, ChatVPN earned more than 50,000 installs. GeckoVPN earned more than 10 million installs. And SuperVPN weighs in as one of the most popular free VPN apps for Android, with more than 100 million installs to its name. Well, I mean, I wonder how they're counting installs. Is that like somebody downloaded it once, tried it for a second, and uninstalled it?
Yeah, I think so. Pump up those numbers.
So, despite SuperVPN's popularity, it is also one of the most harshly reviewed VPN apps for Android devices. Last April, a writer for Tom's Guide found critical vulnerabilities in the app that worried him... that so worried him that the review's headline directed current users to delete it now. More than a month later, a reviewer at TechRadar Pro said SuperVPN had a worthless privacy portal that was cobbled together from other companies' privacy policies and which directly contradicted itself.
God damn.
Yeah, so this is what this is cut and paste bullshit, right? This is I'm going to stand up a free app. I'm going to run a little, you know, VPN service out of, you know, whatever system, reselling it, and just collect all their data and sell it to advertisers. Because, you know, I mean, it's the old adage. If you're not paying for the service, you are the product.
There is.
So if you are going to use a VPN for anything, and I've used a few, pay for them. If you really, really want to be secure, if you really want to run a good VPN that you know what it's doing, build your own. And yes, I mean, go get an account with, you know, AWS or Linode or DigitalOcean. Go read a few tutorials. You should probably know what you're doing better than reading a few online tutorials, now that I think about it. So read a lot of, you know, online tutorials and, you know, how crypto works and what VPNs do. Then go build your own VPN and a VPS. And understand that your traffic leaving that VPS will still be logged. But those companies do not, you know, specialize themselves as a traffic provider, VPN service provider, or anything like that. So their logs are going to be as though it's any other server or service on their system. So at least they're not designing themselves around making money from your logs. They're still going to log, but you know, that way you at least have a clue of what's going on. You know, and yes, that's going to be a lot more expensive than using a free VPN. But it's probably worth it because, you know, it sounds to me like all your clear text passwords going through these VPNs are logged and dumped now. Yeah, not more than 1 year later, the privacy policy has again been thrown in the spotlight with a data leak that calls into question just what type of information the app was actually collecting. According to the thief who pilfered the information from the three VPNs, the data for sale includes email addresses, usernames, full names, country names, randomly generated password strings, payment-related data, and a user's, quote, premium status, unquote, with the corresponding expiration date. Following the forum post, the tech outlet Cyber News also discovered that the stolen data included device serial numbers, phone type, manufacturer information, device IDs, and IMSI numbers. You know, the thing that you need if you want to clone somebody's cell phone. Given how many banks you've
I've always
text
wanted
messages.
To listen to all these people's phone calls.
That's not what you want to do. Most banks use text message. Well, a lot of services use text messages to a registered phone number as a, you know, your two-factor verification, especially if you've forgot your password. So, you know, with this dump, you clone their cell phone. You've got their email password, probably, because it sounds like that got logged in there. You log into their email account. You just go start getting into their other systems, bank, you know, whatever. I mean, according to Cyber News, the data was taken from publicly available databases that were left vulnerable by the VPN providers due to developers leaving default database credentials in use. I mean, for fuck's sake, change the damn default password. I mean, really.
It's such a good password. No one's going to think to check it. Everyone's told to change it. So no one's going to think it's still there.
It wasn't a good password. Why is it the default? You know, the company wouldn't put a shit password on there as the default.
Assuming any particular phrase is not the password is stupid because it takes literally less than a second to check and see if something's the password because you can script these things. It's literally how a dictionary attack works. You think the default passwords for your service aren't going to be in my dictionary?
Of course they're going to be, because they're in mine.
One of the best password dictionaries I ever built. I still have it and occasionally still break it out and use it. When I worked for the school, I built an SSH honeypot and simply collected every login thrown at a random IP address running SSH. Wasn't really
running
it.
I have a copy of that.
Wasn't really. Did I give you a copy of that?
Yeah, way back in the day, man.
Yeah, that thing's amazing.
Yeah.
It's still good. So yeah, for months, I just ran a service pretending to be SSH that just collected any login thrown at it. And then I ran it through a few scripts to dedupe it and organize it. Dude, that was the best damn password database that I'd ever built for cracking things. I say that I built. Obtained.
Friendly people.
Say what?
Provided to you by friendly research assistants who didn't know they were part of your project.
I mean, they were just probing the security of my company. I don't know that they would have given me a report, but they were probing. I mean, you know, they were just testing.
They were outsourced pen testers. May or may not have been eating curry. Good people.
Anyways, back to the article. The unfortunate truth about recent VPN app data leak is that this type of data mishap is nothing new. 2019, popular VPN provider NordVPN confirmed to TechCrunch that it had suffered a breach the year before. Separate from the Nord breach, last July, 7 VPN providers were found to have left 1.2 terabytes of private user data exposed online, according to a report published by the cybersecurity researchers at VPN Mentor. According to the report, the exposed data belonged to as many as 20 million users. The data included email addresses, clear text passwords, IP, home addresses, phone models, device IDs, and internet activity logs. The 7 VPNs investigated by VPN Mentor were UFO VPN, Fast VPN, Free VPN, Super VPN, Flash VPN, Secure VPN, and Rabbit VPN. Okay, I'm done with this article. If you want to run a VPN, you need to understand what it's doing. A VPN connection tunnels your system's network traffic to the VPN server before dumping it on the internet. So these servers can potentially see everything you're doing online, and they have your VPN login associated to it. So if you do want to run one of these VPNs, and there are good reasons to do so, by the way, take some time, do your research, find a good one. I've used private internet access in the past. It's all right. I'm not real happy with the company that bought it. We talked about that on Decking because that company doesn't have as good a reputation, but as far as I can tell, private internet access is still okay. There's a few others floating around out there. Pirate Bay started one up that's still pretty good. DPView says he likes Molvad. Generally, if you can pay for the VPN anonymously in Bitcoin and not actually associate it with your real accounts, they're probably on the better end of the spectrum. What you really want to look for is a VPN that has, you know, had subpoenas issued against it and had to say, I don't have that data to give you. You can send a parcel with money to Molvad VPN. you could drop them the middle of an envelope of money. That's awesome. Yeah, that's the kind of service you want. You want somebody who's been, you know, had a subpoena in court and had to say, sorry, we really don't log. I know a lot of companies say they don't log. We really don't. You find one that's got a review on it that talks about that. Now you're talking, and you don't want to run these VPNs all the time. I know several of these VPN providers say, oh, you should just run it all the time. No. The only time you want to run these type of private VPNs is when you're on a network you do not trust. You know, hotel Wi-Fi networks, coffee shops, you know, when you're staying with your weird friend who lives under the bridge. old Greasy Larry, you know, shit like that. You know, you're on some strange school network that does weird filters and things like that. What you do not want to do when you're on these VPNs is you do not want to log in to, you know, your financials, you know, banking, your Amazon accounts, anything where you potentially have your credit card or your money attached to it. Whether or not you trust the VPN, it's just not a good idea when you're on a weird network to log into these things just in case the VPN ever gets popped. Like, I know Nord had their breach. They weren't intending for this kind of stuff to happen, but it did because somebody got into one of their servers. Because building secure networks is hard. So again, that's one of the reasons why at first I was thinking, well, maybe I should just tell people to build their own. But now that I think about it, doing that correctly is hard. So I don't know that telling you to build your own is the best advice, especially if you don't know what you're doing. So, you know, if you want to have services like that and have them available, especially if you're going to be on networks you don't trust much, that's fine. Or if you're wanting to do the whole, you know, change what your point of origin is for whatever reason, whether you're trying to, you know, view videos from a different, you know, from a different country, or, I don't know, get around website bans or other bullshit like that. You know, that's when you use these kind of things. You don't want to be using them 24/7 because then these guys see everything you're doing all the time. And the real thing you have to be careful with on, like, your phone is you have a lot of apps that are, you know, once you've authenticated to them, they're always logged in the background. So if you get one of these shady VPNs on your phone, you know, God knows what data it's collecting off your phone just by running in the background, let alone by catching all your network traffic. So again, you know, you really want to make sure that you're not the product if you're using something like this. And you need to understand what it's really doing. I've got nothing else on that. You guys got anything?
No, I'm good, man.
I've seen VPNs advertise, use them to kind of screw Comcast out of getting their money from selling your data. You're not pro, use it just to avoid other people monetizing you?
I mean, if you think your ISP is doing that, that's an option. I would say get a new ISP if you have the option. I know that's hard. You know, I've only got the one where I live. But you understand that whatever VPN provider you pick, they might be doing the same thing. So you need to make sure you pick one that's not if you're going to be pumping everything through it.
Boom.
You know, again, that's why I like the idea of finding one of the ones that you can pay in Bitcoin without tying to a real address or, you know, if they're monitoring all your traffic and, you know, you're doing online shopping and stuff through that, they might eventually figure out who you are anyways. But at least you can, you know, try to segment. If you really are in that situation where you think my ISP is spying on me and I don't want them selling my data, find two or three good VPNs and rotate through them. Don't always go through the same one. At least then you're segmenting out where you're coming from and you're not... I mean, you're in a tough spot when that's happening, right? That's where you really hope that a lot of websites you're visiting are doing proper encryption, so at least the network in the middle isn't seeing everything you do. So, speaking of internet tracking, though, this article's from The Verge. Google promises it won't just keep tracking you after replacing cookies.
No, I promise, guys, totally.
Google is slowly phasing out third-party tracking cookies, and today it's making it clear that it won't just replace them with something equally invasive, despite the impact the change will have on Google's lucrative advertising business. In a blog post, Google explicitly states that it will, quote, will not build alternative identifiers to track individuals as they browse across the web, unquote, after third-party cookies are gone. Quote, instead, our web products will be powered by privacy-preserving APIs, which prevent individual tracking while still delivering results for advertisers and publishers, unquote, writes Google. Quote, advances in aggregation, anonymization, and on-device processing and other privacy-preserving technologies offer a clear path to replacing individual identifiers, unquote. Third-party cookies have been blocked for a while in Safari and Firefox, though the browsers differed in how far they go, and Google plans on doing the same in Chrome. The cookies allow advertisers to track you as you move between different websites, which gives advertisers a better idea of what your interests are. These hyper-targeted ads are very valuable resulting in the creation of an ad industry where individual user data is proliferated across thousands of companies, according to Google. Google says this practice has led to users not trusting the internet or advertisers. No shit. I mean, you're nozzling them up the ass, and you're wondering why they don't trust you. which puts the future of the web at risk. For all the privacy concerns, advertising is still the primary way many companies on the internet make their money, The Verge and Google included. That's why Google said it wants to move away from third-party cookies and towards a more, quote, privacy-first web, unquote. For all the talk of privacy, Google makes it clear it's not trying to get rid of targeted advertising in general. It just wants to replace the more invasive methods of old with a new one of its own design, which it calls Privacy Sandbox. It tells you what Google thinks of you right there. They're going to put you in the sandbox.
Don't worry, children. We're not going to let everyone sell to you. We're just going to let us sell to you. Don't worry, you'll get the same percentage of ads. They'll just be from one company instead of, I don't know, five.
Part of Privacy Sandbox's job is to hide the individual inside a large crowd of cohorts with similar interests it will then target ads towards. Oh, like they don't already do this on the back end. I've explained this before, but we'll get into it. A teardown of the Chrome 89 Beta APK by Android Police gives us a first look at Privacy Sandbox controls and the use of, quote, web crowd, unquote, cohorts for more relevant advertising. They've got some screenshots here of join the web crowd. So, yeah, instead of it being individualized to you, they pick a box to put you in based on your interests, and then advertise to the box. Which, by the way, that's what they do on the back end anyways. They're not going to advertisers and say, hey, I'm tracking Madman. He likes conservative politics, Rand Paul, and My Little Pony. Instead, they're going to the advertiser and saying, I've got 500,000 conservatives you can target an ad to. I've got 10,000 people who, you know, I forget whatever the jokes I made about Madman's interests now.
I like what the model pony would be. He's a fan of Spike. Have fun with that.
I actually,
the little dragon. My Little Pony.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, no clue here either.
Nieces, nephews, and sisters.
Yeah, I tried to make the same joke at Static, and then he starts going on about the show, and I'm like, wait, what? And he goes, I have daughters. I'm like, oh, yeah. So that joke only works if somebody doesn't have, you know, children around them. Google's embrace of privacy-first web comes among increasing regulatory pressure across the globe. The company acknowledges that while noting some of its competitors will still pursue solutions built around individual identities. Quote, we realize this means other providers may offer a level of user identity for ad tracking across the web that we will not, like PII graphs based on people's email addresses, writes Google. We don't believe these solutions will meet rising consumer expectations for privacy, nor will they stand up to a rapidly evolving regulatory restrictions and therefore aren't sustainable long-term investment. In other words, Google sees the writing on the wall. There's going to be laws about this shit soon, especially after the fact that the last couple of presidential elections have been influenced pretty heavily by Facebook and Twitter, so YouTube. So they see the writing on the wall, and they're like, okay, we need to start at least getting into something that can be, you know, not quite as easy to smack down. Anything?
Oh, man, not much to be said on it.
All right, next one's just funny. It's from The Drive. .com. It's part of their website called The War Zone, actually. Yeah, DPView thinks they're doing that to try to avoid getting broken up. And, you know, do the brave thing with Chrome and just show you their ads instead built into the browser. Yeah, I could see them doing that. I don't know, because they've got the whole Chromium base there, so something like that would be pretty obvious. Although now they're trying to tone back the amount of people using Chromium and limiting that browser a bit. So, I don't know. We'll see. You know, I'm sure Apple's having some influence, too, in the fact that they're getting more and more focused on making sure they ask the user before they let apps do all this tracking. You know, if they keep that up, I'll probably switch back to iPhone for my next phone, which is going to be a bit till this one's paid off. But, you know, well, paid off, and then I decide I need a new phone. That's the thing. When I bought this one, I didn't actually need a new phone, but they had, you know, a new toy on it I wanted to play with, and it's actually never even used. So I guess that's a waste of money. Anyways, I don't know that I want to read this whole article because it kind of goes into it. Short version of it, on a Air Force hiring website, they're looking for engineers to help reverse engineer parts of the B-2 stealth bomber.
What happened to the plans?
They don't have the plans?
They apparently do not. An official...
Why?
Yeah, a surprising turn of events. The United States government is calling upon its country's industry to reverse engineer components for the Air Force B-52 stealth bomber. Official calls it highly official call for this highly unusual kind of assistance was put out today on U.S. government contracting site beta.sam.gov. Yeah,
call up Lockheed Martin and ask them for the plans.
They're gonna have it.
The notice, which seeks engineering effort that will reverse engineer key parts for the B-2's load heat exchangers, while it's not exactly clear what part of the aircraft's many complex and exotic subsystems these heat exchangers relate to, the bomber has no shortage of it. So there are parts of the B-52 that apparently nobody knows how to make anymore. So the government is trying to recruit people to help. You know, first part of the reverse engineering is to do an obsolescence study. If we cannot find or get parts to fix a piece of equipment or replace it, then we have to go back to the customer or the supply chain with the item and ask them what they want us to do. So, yeah, basically, they don't have parts to fix these things. So now they're trying to get people to help them reverse engineer it.
Yeah, I call bullshit on the story.
I mean...
They're looking for engineers to reverse something they don't want to talk about.
That could
I find
be.
It extremely dubious that fucking Lockheed Martin or someone doesn't have the specs for this thing.
Or maybe they want so much money for it that it's cheaper to hire people to reverse engineer it.
Well, maybe, but I've got money on something else.
You're right, because they wouldn't have patented any of that. Get a patent, it has to be public knowledge.
Yeah,
you have
there's
to know
no
what's
patents.
Being patented.
You think
but somebody has it, pen and paper.
Oh, yeah, Lockheed Martin has it.
Yeah.
So you think they've got their hands on something else and they want help reverse engineering that?
Yeah, I'm not instantly going to Ancient Aliens or anything like that.
I was thinking
that.
Chinese or Russian, but okay, aliens,
that's,
sure.
That's what I was thinking. They've got something that, you know, is similar to the B-52, but was built somewhere else by another state actor, and they need people who've had engineering experience with that aircraft. Hey, come take a look at this. We're not really sure how they put the heat exchangers together or something like that, but they're not actively going, hey, we're the world's superpower and we've misplaced the plans to one of our deadliest aircraft. Like,
they have the Chinese copy of the B-52, and they're trying to figure out how good of a copy it is.
Well, it's
or not B-52,
it may be.
It's the
B-2. You know what I mean?
I'm sorry. That's important. It's the B-2 stealth bomber.
I
it's
just
not the
find it. I find it highly dubious. And they're like, "Yeah, we're so inept. You know, in this administration and in previous, we didn't keep anything." Bullshit.
I just
tell me
it was
another
funny.
One. I know, man. It was a good story, and it's But it's not true.
Okay.
It can't be true. If it is true, holy shit. What have you people done with that country?
Oh, what did Lockheed do to that company? Because they have a guaranteed sell on replacement parts.
Yes.
They're the only ones that make this shit.
You sort of see where I'm calling a little bullshit on the story here.
Now, granted, they only have one customer for it, but that customer can tax the shit out of its people to pay whatever price.
And that $8 pot turns into $80,000 really fucking quickly when someone else is paying for it.
I mean, we're negotiating a relief bill that's 3 times larger than the GDP we're estimated to lose. They're not worried about pinching pennies when it comes to spare parts. Lockheed Martin kept those designs.
I like what DPView says. You have a customer that can literally pay you to print money to pay you.
Yeah, you're not throwing away those in a drunken clean out.
The one dude that had the password to that server died.
What? in the plans for that plane actually something like 20 years old? That's possible.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, the B-2's old.
So. No, I'm calling bullshit.
Fair enough. Speaking of something else to call bullshit on, this one's from Torup Freak. Lost the key pass master pass. Oh, that would suck. Yeah, so you know that button that says recompute base encryption hash? It's right next to logout.
I might have hit that one.
So, you know how you guys said not to smoke in the server room? Well... they could have a flood in the server. I've seen that one. When you see companies build server rooms in closets that should not be server rooms, and then they decide to cool that closet by installing window AC units in the ceiling, they don't realize that condensate has to go somewhere. So
they don't have a hose outside of the building?
Oh no, because they just put it in a closet and then put a lock on the closet, right? So the condensate will build up on top of the drop ceiling until the drop ceiling fails. And then you have a flood in your server room.
You want mushrooms on your hard drives? That's how you get mushrooms on your hard drive.
Yeah. So ask me how I know about that one. That's how data hard drive data recovery companies make a lot of money. Oh, this one's from Torrent Freak, and it's just funny. Nearly three decades ago, the Software and Information Industry Association released the infamous Don't Copy That Floppy PSA. Anybody remember that shit?
No.
The guy doing the Don't Copy That Floppy song? You don't remember that?
Using AOL disks for my homework. I didn't copy it. I overwrote it and used it for something more useful.
This thing was back in the days of DOS games, Windows 3.1. And really, it had to be Amiga and Xcopy they were targeting with this thing. But anyways, to educate kids on the harms of online piracy. No, it was not online piracy at the time, buddy. Might have been BBS's, but it was not online piracy. Today, software piracy remains a problem, and the industry group is still calling on the public for help. They're now offering a potential $1 million reward. So let's skip ahead here, because I don't care about the Don't Copy That Floppy song. It's funny, but I don't, because they got like, you know, two generic high school kids who the guy starts singing in the computer because they're going to steal a game from a school computer, which, I mean, my God, you want to talk about out of touch. Despite the success of their anti-piracy campaign three decades ago, we still haven't heard much from the Software Publishers Association recently. The industry group, currently known as the Software and Information Industry Association, hasn't taken any pirates or pirate services to court, as far as we know. This doesn't mean that SIA is no longer concerned with copyright infringement. Instead of fighting casual users of pirate sites, it now focuses on corporate copyright infringement. The industry group has a special section on its website that's dedicated to reporting piracy. According to CISA, unauthorized copying results in an estimated $8 billion in lost sales. Well, I don't know that it's lost
potential
sales. Yeah.
Potential lost sales.
You wouldn't download a floppy. The hell I wouldn't. Have you seen my library of DOS and Amiga games?
I'm just amazed this song goes for 4 minutes.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. It's hilarious and terrible at the same time. Because somebody got paid to make this, like, a lot of money. piracy is stealing. We need your help to combat this crime. If you see something, say something. Report issues of piracy here. SIA advocates for the industry and protects intellectual property from theft. By reporting software piracy to Sierra, you could earn up to $1 million, they promise. At the same time, they offer strict confidentiality to whistleblowers. Needless to say, this approach is quite different from the Don't Copy That Floppy campaign. While rewards for reporting piracy are now are not new, $1 million is a substantial amount of money that pales in comparison with a few hundred dollars or pounds theater employees can get. That said, look at Sia's fine print. It becomes clear that one has to get very lucky to hit the jackpot. For one, the reward only applies to situations where corporations use pirated software. If someone reports an issue at his or her employer, Sia may choose to follow up, which could ultimately lead to a settlement. The scale of the settlement will determine the award. If all the eligibility requirements are met and the settlement amount paid to Sia is at least $10,000, the source will be considered a reward of $500. Sia may increase the reward to as much as $1 million, depending on the amount of piracy reported by the source and the settlement amount collected by Sia. In other words, $500 is a lot more likely than $1 million, according to the terms of the conditions. There are several other caveats. The reward only applies to cases where Sia reaches settlement outside of court. If it actually goes to court, Sia may still choose to reimburse the whistleblower for their time, but that's not guaranteed. In fact, even when all the requirements are met, Sia may choose not to pay anything. So, I don't see this website as a way to get a $1 million payday. I see this as a way to harass an employer that you're pissed off with.
Yeah, they're not paying out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just read what DPV wrote in the IRC. I'm not going to read that out, but that's hilarious.
I'd be more concerned in whether or not he's a hacker. He has other issues.
Are you a fairy?
No. I identify as a red dragon. I'm evil, bitch.
Peak clown world. I got nothing else on that. Anybody have anything, or do you guys want to move on to Dojo?
I'm good.
Let's move on to Dojo.
So Psychro sent this one to me tonight, which is awesome. And it's from, the article he sent me is from pagetable.com. And they've posted the source at GitHub, so I've got both links here. So let me post I forgot to put the links in the IRC and the... So the first link is the actual article, and the second link is the GitHub link where you can download the source code. Don't duplicate that solid state. That's terrible. At least don't copy that floppy rhymed.
I stole that from the
comments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was amusing.
So Psychro sent me this. This is awesome. Commodore Basic as a scripting language for Unix and Windows, and it's open source. This is awesome. The application is a recompiled version of the original, and this is actually from 2008, but they've open sourced it, and so it hasn't been updated in years, but it's 100% compatible. So it's like, this is awesome. Is a recompiled version of the original Commodore 64 binary. It is not a re-implementation. So while it runs at the maximum possible speed, it's still about 100% compatible. The huge C file in the archive has been produced by feeding the original 6502 code into a static recompiler and optimizing with LLVM. The original operating system interface, character I/O, load save, etc., has been re-implemented in native C. So Commodore Basic interfaces nicely with OS X, Windows, or Unix, and you can pipe I/O, and you can pass the file name of Basic program on the command line. This is Commodore 64 Basic implemented on modern operating systems as a scripting language. I want to find a way to implement this at work just to piss off the next person who has to work on that box. I think this is awesome. And if nothing else, if it's 100% compatible, you should be able to grab old Commodore Basic programs and run them on a modern machine. And they had in here a stat that it's running, you know, on a gigahertz CPU, you get about 1,000 times the speed of the 1 megahertz 6502. It's not emulating 6502, so any assembler calls, and I'm betting peek and poke calls, won't really work. But, you know, if something's pure basic code, should run fine. And since it implements a system call, you should be able to call back out to the main OS with the system. So you could potentially do real work in Commodore BASIC on a machine. Again, the only real purpose to this would be to piss off the next person who works at the system until they figure out what it is. But I think this is amazing. So this is Digital Dojo tonight. And I guess you guys have nothing?
No, I was wondering, that just like running on a modern machine, use this to play old Commodore games on a modern machine?
Potentially. If they're pure basic games, you could.
Right. Some of those old games, didn't they use the processor speed to determine how fast the enemies went?
Yeah, well, a lot of those old games did. And that was one of the things about a lot of the old 8-bit micros, is the hardware was fairly uniform. If I had a Commodore 64, it was basically the same as anybody else's. I'm aware there are multiple revisions and that, you know, different, you know, SID chips sounded a little bit different. And, you know, the video chips are sometimes a little different based on the revision. And you might have a memory expander, but, you know, usually there wasn't much need for that with those systems at the time. And most of the games for those were written in assembler, not in BASIC. So really, if you're wanting to play Commodore 64 games, you're better off running an emulator.
I was just thinking how fast the ghosts would move on a modern piece, lesser.
Oh yeah, that would be complete. Well, it would either be completely unplayable, or it would be a game that was unplayable on the original hardware suddenly becomes very playable on a modern machine because BASIC on the Commodore is really slow. So if it's really running that fast, I mean, it would be a completely usable language even for things like that, right? So, you know, something that was way too slow in native BASIC on a C64 might actually be useful on a modern machine implementing it. But I just thought this was great and hilarious. So,
and like, oh, you could have your Commodores talk to the rest of your network now.
I already did that, but the network card had a better processor than the damn machine itself, so...
The other computers could talk back? They might be able to understand each other?
Oh, RU, I assume you have nothing.
I have nothing, sir.
All right. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday. Galaxy 15 Radio site and subreddit. In the IRC tonight, myself, Sardonic, Cyber Dystopia, Cyber Large, Psychros, DP View, Madman, and the Coffee Maker. Madman, closing thoughts.
I want to play Pac-Man now. No. Oregon Trail.
That was an Apple game. I always played that one on the Apple II. Actually, they put out a little handheld version of the Oregon Trail. I don't know if you'll find it. Not now, but yeah. Are you closing thoughts?
I have a prediction, actually.
Uh-oh.
I think a man by the name of Doug Band will kill himself in the next 2 weeks with roughly 3 to 10 bullets to the back of his skull.
The fuck?
If you follow anything to do with Epstein, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Okay. Well, that's all I have. I'm going to play sound effects.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Sounds good. Nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.